Welcome back to the Nutrition and Life podcast. My name is Lisa. I'm your host. And in today's episode, I'm speaking with David Amerland, author of Built to Last. David and I speak about what he calls the paradox of fitness, why he considers the brain a hidden organ, and why we should meditate on death more regularly. I hope you enjoy the episode. And please, if you like the show, subscribe and give us a rating or take a screenshot and share the episode on your social media. Thank you so much. And as always, if you want personalized help with your nutrition and fitness goals, we are your go-to coaches. Just hit the contact link in the show notes for more details. Now on to my conversation with David. David Amerland, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
I am excited that you're talking to me today as well and to all our listeners and telling us more about your book, Built to Last, but more importantly, to also just share with us your philosophy about fitness and sustainable health. So, first of all, what's the number one thing you are excited for our listeners to take away from this conversation today?
I really want everybody who listens to this podcast to understand that fitness is non-negotiable in their lives and that the tiny changes they can make in their everyday lifestyle or their everyday sort of activities will have a huge impact as they get older.
Oh, wonderful. I love that. I do truly hope that that message sinks in very, very deeply, and love how you mentioned that, or how you called it a non-negotiable, because that's truly what it should be. It should be like sleep, like eating on a regular basis, that we just think we need to get some movement in, whether it's just quote unquote walking, or whether it's a proper strength training workout. So please tell us how it came about that you wrote this book, Built to Last, and what your message in it is as well.
Okay, so I never intended to write a book on fitness. And I've been fit all my life. I've been training since I was 13. And I have a black belt in three different martial arts styles. I've done sports all my life. And for all the time since I was 13, I've pretty much trained every day, the whole year. I've always done something. There hasn't been a single day when I haven't done anything. And I know it sounds very disciplined. And it sounds very driven. It's driven, but not disciplined. It's kind of necessary. When I got into it, it was my safety valve, and it continued to be my safety valve, the thing that kept me sane. So for me, it's a coping behavior that simply became my lifestyle and allowed me to function at a high level, despite the stress that I was feeling in my life. So Built to Last came about as a result of conversations and I had with friends, in particular one friend. I have a friend who's a cop, and we train together once a week as a standing sort of arrangement. I have a home gym. He has a home gym. So we train on our own, but also once a week, it's a social thing. We get together for a couple of hours. We do the stuff we do. And if anybody who's trained with another person understands that the moment you're training with somebody, because you're talking, the intensity level can actually go up and you don't feel the strain. So you can do things which are harder, which we like. And we talk, and he used to tell me, the things he'd read about fitness, which sometimes were kind of myths, and we'd bust them together and say, why this doesn't work or whatever. Well, I have some new study, which I'll bring up, and I'll say, listen, this is what they say, and this is how bodies change over time. This is what we should be doing. We should be looking at this or looking at that. And through those conversations over a period of about 3 years, the seed that became Built to Last came about. So that's how it started.
Very cool. Again, it sounds like it's a combination of personal experience, philosophy, but also very grounded and rooted in science and things that
yes.
You and your friend have accumulated and brought together, in the sense of the latest research, or maybe just also trying things on your own and seeing how does that affect my body, how does that affect your body, and comparing and also collecting things that way. So really, really cool. And I took a look through the book, and also more specifically the chapters of the book, and I really like how you started it off with the first title, which is Paradox of Fitness. I would love to hear what you mean by that, or if you can explain to our listeners what you exactly mean by the paradox of fitness.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for bringing it up. Now, we live in a world of plenty. We have staggering amounts of information at our fingertips. We know more than ever from science of how the body operates, how we operate. We know more about nutrition. We know the necessity for sleep. We know all those things. And we are also exposed to government programs and government drives across the world, which tell us that it's important to keep fit. We are exposed to tremendous amounts of advertising by the fitness industry, which is huge globally. And we are culturally exposed to films and songs and posters and every kind of sort of popular image, which gives us an idealized sort of picture of fitness. So that kind of gets driven into us that it's important. And despite all that, the World Health Organization projection for 2050, which is 25 years away from now, is that half the world's adult population is going to be overweight or it's going to be obese. In the States, and these figures are also reflected in pretty much every developed country, only 35% of the population trains 3 times a week. And of those who train 3 times a week, only 15% do so on a sustained basis, which means that they do it regularly. So it's really, really bad. And when it something like that happens, and I've got a sort of scientific background, I look at systems logic. So we look at something like this, and it's not lack of access, it's not lack of information, it's not lack of equipment or even the desire to get fit. I mean, globally, we spend $828 billion on fitness. And in the States, people spend every year upwards of $286 billion on fitness. We get books, we get the gear, we get the shoes, we get the equipment, and then we never use it. So something is fundamentally wrong. And this is the paradox. When something doesn't work out at that level, the problem isn't we don't have access to the information, we don't have access to the means. It's in the way we operate as a system ourselves. So essentially, there's something fundamental in us that stops us from exercising. And this is what we should seek to understand. If we understand that, and I will explain it in a second, then we are in a better position to basically understand why it happens and how to make it go away, or we can work around it. Now, the reason that we don't exercise is because we have a natural aversion to it. People who are fit, you know, you've exercised all your life pretty much as I have. You know that when it comes time, when the time comes for you to go to the gym, at the very back of your head, this is a small voice holding you back. You know, you feel the resistance to it. You feel that, okay, you have things to do, there's work to be done, you're already fit, maybe you should miss a session, go twice as hard the next day. All those excuses that come up. And we have this natural aversion. And this is me, I've exercised all my life. I've got a home gym. I can just, you know, put my laptop down and just walk 10 steps away, and there's my gym. And it's fully equipped, and it's a massive room. I can do anything I want there and still find it hard to actually get there. And the reason that voice exists is because as we evolved through thousands of years, the life we had in that world, which was adversarial for us, was difficult anyway. I mean, the things which we do today to keep fit, the running, the climbing, the lifting, the digging, the working out hard, the cardiovascular fitness, that was our life back then. We'd have to do those things in order to survive. So when we didn't have to do those things, the body in order to, or the brain in order to help the body survive, had to conserve energy. So there are neurobiological mechanisms which help us avoid the stress of exercise by creating that negative association with it, which we don't analyze because it's a feeling most of the time. We sort of don't feel like it. We're not in the mood. We're going to exercise later. And the excuse is always very logical. You know, we are emotional machines that think as opposed to thinking machines that feel. So when we feel something, our brain is really, really good at giving us all the excuses that will kind of justify that feeling. And this is the problem we actually face. So knowing that now, knowing why this happens, understanding that this aversion is natural, then we have to ourselves implement strategies in our life, in our lifestyle, in the way we actually set things up to make it easier. And I will explain what this means now. Suppose you have the best will in the world to work out. So you go and join a gym, you get your gear, and you get all the stuff you need. And now this is what happens on an average day. You come home from work and you're already tired. You have to pack your bag, you have to find your stuff, you have to put everything in there. You have to go out again now. You've been home and you've chilled a little bit. The weather outside may not be in your favor. It may be cold, it may be rainy, maybe snow. You have to negotiate traffic, find a parking space, go to the gym, undress, get dressed, exercise, and then repeat the process, come back home. And when you consider this from the home point of view in the first instance, it seems like a mountain. And we're going to say, well, it's too cold, it's too dark. The roads are too icy, it's too busy. I'm going to do it, next week, twice as hard. All those things. And it's really important for us to understand that those obstacles, which when we initially plan for them, don't seem so massive because we plan from a good place. On a bad day, they're like mountains and we don't want to climb them. And I understand that. So really the strategies around that, the way that we sort of navigate this kind of difficulty is by having what I call contingency plans. Okay, we've planned to go to the gym 3 times a week. We know that life's going to get messy. We know that things are going to get difficult. We know that sometimes we'll not be able to make that. So what do we do instead? If we accept that exercise is non-negotiable and we need to do something, then we need to have something to do. We need to have a plan for perhaps working out at home for 10 minutes without any equipment, doing some body weight exercises, doing some sort of mini aerobic on the spot if we can do that. If we don't have those 10, 15 minutes that it takes, or half an hour, or however long we plan for that, maybe we should have another plan which says, okay, if I haven't got to it in 20 minutes or 15 minutes, maybe I can have one for 5 minutes. And if we haven't got that, maybe we can say we have one for 1 minute. And now you're going to say, okay, well, 1 minute is not worth anything, right? Why do it? Well, actually, that's not true. We actually have studies which show that if you exercise consistently for 1 minute, then the neurochemical changes in our bloodstream are reflective of the states of neurochemical changes that are there when we have exercised for an hour. So from the point of view of the body, 1 minute or an hour, the same thing. The neurochemical changes have happened, which means that essentially the impact of those neurochemical changes in our brain and our internal organs is going to be the same. Our hormonal profile is going to change. And if we just for the entire year, we do nothing but 1 minute's exercise a day. By the end of the year, we'll have exercised for about roughly 6 hours, and you think, well, this is nothing. True, it is nothing. But we'll be fitter in a better place than if we hadn't done those 6 hours. We may not have massive muscles or look super sleek, but internally we'll be healthier. Our brain health will be better. Our ability to self-regulate our emotions will be better. So these are very important aspects of fitness, which people don't see, but they're essentially tied into our physicality.
I love
So,
it. I think also beyond the physiological effects or lack thereof, what's more important with that contingency of even just a minute or whatever is you don't have the feeling of, I didn't achieve it. I failed. And because of that, the rest of the weekend, the rest of the week, it doesn't matter. And I'm going to get back on quote unquote track next week or whatever. No, you are t continuing to tick that box, even if it is 1 minute, and therefore you're building your own self-belief, you're building your own confidence, and hey, I can keep doing something, I can build a habit. And maybe, maybe that's your year number one, and in year number two, you manage to do an average of 2 minutes of exercise every single year. And maybe the third year you manage to do an average of 3 minutes of exercise every single day. Sorry, I mean, and if you build on that, at some point, the 45-minute or 30-minute workout daily or movement daily is going to be part of your identity because that's essentially what you're building through that contingency. So I absolutely, absolutely love it. You did also mention at the end there, even with that 1 minute, that we have benefits or it has a positive effect on our brain. And that's one thing that you also mentioned in your book. You mentioned it, the hidden organ, or name it the hidden organ, and that being the brain. Tell us a little bit about that aspect, that chapter, or why you consider it an organ.
okay, if we do anything physical, walk for a bit or run or lift a weight, after a certain amount of time, we actually feel the effects. We get tired. Adenosine triphosphate, ATP, is used up by the cells. And as that sort of is exhausted and replenished, the fatigue mechanisms kick in. And because the body has nerve cells which report back to us, we have proprioception, we're aware of the fatigue and we know that we've worked out. The brain also uses ATP, uses exactly the same fuel as the body. So if we sit there thinking deeply, we basically use ATP. If we feel stressed, we use ATP, which is why if we feel stressed, we're actually tired. The thing is that the brain hasn't got nerve cells. There's no reporting mechanism which tells us, oh, the brain got tired, you need to give it a rest. So we never feel it does anything. And the thing is, it does absolutely so many things every single time. If we take a deep breath and we have fMRI sort of scans to prove this, we take a deep, deep breath to decompress. The brain stem at the very center of the very base of our brain moves by as much as 5 centimeters. So this is staggering. And we don't feel that. Although if we are stressed and we take a deep breath, we kind of feel something in our head, which is a sense of that movement. But because there are no nerve cells there, you know, we're not aware of it. But we kind of feel that change in sort of pressure, internal pressure in the brain because of that movement. Because the brain is involved in everything, and we don't know it is, we tend to overlook it. We think, oh, you know, I need to exercise my body. You are basically also exercising your mind, and your mind also can affect your body. And the two are not separate. We used to think, okay, it's this or that. And it's actually, there's nothing the body can do that is not governed by the brain. And there's so many different levels which we need to unpack here. One is obviously the neurological one. The brain sends signals to the body then activates motor neurons, and we move. And it's the same whether we walk or sit or stand or jump or kick or lift weights. And the number of times we can do that, the dexterity we can actually bring about, the intensity of the workout itself, which will depend on how many motor neurons are recruited in every single movement, will to some extent depend on the strength of that signal. And if that signal is weak because we're tired, we're stressed, we're exhausted, the quality of our workout goes down. So this is a very direct aspect. At the same time, the movement of the body affects the neurochemistry of the brain. If we've been stressed and we move, we walk, we jump, we dance, what happens? We feel happier. Stress goes away because the neurochemistry in our brain has actually changed. So there's a constant bidirectional conversation between brain and body. And this is on a physical level. But there are other elements to this. There's a psychological one. We have a sizable body of scientific work which shows that the way we imagine ourselves as we do things is reflected back by the performance of our body. The particular thing here that sometimes, you know, we watch people train in films and in movies and in gyms, and they're in front of a mirror and they watch themselves do an exercise, and you think it's a vanity thing. And it could well be that, but essentially there is a very direct link there because the feedback we get from the mirror allows us to allows the body to focus on the movement and the brain to concentrate on it. And this is what we know. If we do the exactly same thing, one person does it blindfolded and the other person watches themselves do it in the mirror. And let's say we do curls, which is a bicep curl, classic vanity move. The results of the person actually watching themselves do it can vary in terms of performance, in terms of effect of how the muscles respond afterwards, by as much as 15%, which is staggering. So that's that feedback, that visual feedback of the image of our brain that sees the body working out actually allows the body to perform at a higher level. So this is one element of that. There's another element, which is how we imagine ourselves as we change. And a lot of the stuff which we do, in order for it to be sustainable, has to be emotionally connected to us. I mean, you mentioned earlier that we through exercise, we build identity. You're absolutely correct. If we don't tie our identity to what we do, which means that our emotionality then is integrated into the physicality of what we are taking part of, then the value that we ascribe to a stressor we're going to undergo for some kind of expected result, which becomes all the more uncertain, is going to drop, and we're going to drop out. We're not going to do it properly. We're going to say we're too tired. We're going to say, oh, my body hurts. Tension will go. We'll get bored. Life will get messy. exercise is going to go by the side, out of the way, unless we're emotionally connected to it, unless it's become part of who we are and who we want to become. And then the value we ascribe to the stressor we experience drops, so the stressor is not as hard anymore. The value we ascribe and the weight of that value to what we're actually trying to achieve goes up. So then our motivation changes. And motivation, essentially at a neuroscientific level, is a chemical soup in our brain that takes us from a place of discomfort to a place of greater comfort. So, we need to have that emotional connection and this reassignation of values in order for us to be able to do it sustainably over the long term.
You explained this so nicely, the various aspects, and I think if we tie all of them together, it's so clear how our body is just really a holistic system and how everything is interconnected and just communicating from both ends to another. And I'll give you an example that comes up for me to the point of what you said there about what value we attribute to something. So I personally, and people that know me know this, I hate the cold. I despise the cold. I do my very, very best to chase summers, I love the sauna, give me the beach every single day, right? But nonetheless, this year I decided to undergo the experiment of subjecting myself to cold plunging. And the very first time I got in, my whole body and my whole system was screaming, "Lisa, are you freaking crazy? Get out of this. This is dumb. You're gonna die." And I managed to have a sort of like a metacognition conversation with myself and just be like, I basically used the mantra of, "This is good for you. This is good for you." I just kept reiterating, like, imagine the health, the dopamine you're gonna feel afterwards. Imagine how great you're gonna sleep tonight, how good this is for anti-inflammation. I kept telling, even though the other half of me kept screaming, like, "No, you're dumb. Get out of this." Like, literally came to the point where my feet and my hands were tingling and sort of almost numb. But after a while, I realized, or I could feel my breath sort of relax, my heartbeat slow down, and the other half won, thankfully, and was just like, "This is good for you." And so now, believe it or not, I mean, I'm only like 10 sessions in, but I'm very, very, very proud of myself because truly, I hate the cold. And I'm literally looking forward to this. Like, I mean, I'm hating still every single second while I'm in it, but I'm like, beforehand, I've almost built up like a positive anticipation. And afterwards, I'm just so proud of myself that I got through it doing something that I truly intrinsically hate. But it was honestly that, like, if I would not have perceived or I would not have attributed that value to it, and someone would have just thrown me into cold water, it would have been a completely different story. I continued to tell myself I'm gonna die because it's so cold or whatever, but because I was able to reframe that and just tell myself, "You're the person who does a cold plunging experiment, who benefits from cold plunging," it was very interesting for me to almost witness that from the outside, how my body and my mind started to accept these circumstances. So,
I
yeah.
love that. And thank you so much for bringing this up. I'm going to sort of unpack it a little bit because there are a lot of elements there. And first of all, congratulations. Doing that is tremendous willpower, which then changes both your brain and your body. And there are documented effects at a practical level of how the body changes when it's exposed to the cold. But what we don't see so often is how the brain changes. Essentially, the stress coping mechanism which we have is the same for everything, whether you're facing a crisis in your personal life or at work or going to cold plunge, the mechanism is the same. Part of you screams, you don't want to be here. Your body goes into fight or flight response. Your heartbeat goes up. Your brain shuts down. The higher centers of your brain shut down because they're energetically expensive. So your body is preparing for action. So you lose the ability to think clearly. And then you want to get out, and you don't. And you have to talk to yourself and find the reasons to stay. And you said you talk to yourself, oh, this is good for you. And this is a psychological technique called distancing. I don't know if you watch The Matrix, the first movie with Trinity. She's going down the stairs and she's freezing there, and she's expecting the agent to come in, and she's frozen in fear. And then she says, "Get up, Trinity," right? Talking to herself in a third person. Okay, the moment we do that, this is what happens to the brain. Essentially, the brain splits in two almost, because there's a voice which now has to coach you. In order to do that, it divides its resources. And the moment it does that, the fear which you felt is dampened down because it's shared. So now you are able to manage it. It's not overpowering you. And it's the same with stress. So you're saying to yourself, you can do this, this is good for you, until suddenly you realize you can do it. And then you're empowered. So this is fantastic. It's absolutely, really, really good. And then, it's what you said, you reframed it. And that's magic. There's a 2020 study carried out by Stanford University. It was a psychology lab at Stanford University. They carried out a study in 2020 where they followed 174 Navy SEALs as they underwent their 4-week training. Now, Navy SEALs, by the time they apply to be Navy SEALs, they're already a made product, right? They're fit, they're confident, they're disciplined, they've already been through the army training, and they're ready for the next level. And they go through 4 weeks of training, which is basically selection. And the second week of that is called Hell Week for a reason, because they're pushed to the absolute limit of their brain and body. And 75% of them fail. So they wanted to see what's the difference, because on paper they look so alike that those who fail shouldn't, and those who stayed could have failed, and they can't understand why. So they carried out the study, and they carried out all sorts of experiments on them and sort of fMRI sort of testing. And this is what they found. The ones who failed are going through Hell Week, and they tell themselves, this is hard, this is hell, it's grinding me down, I can't stand it, and it's hurting me. And the ones who stayed said, this is hard, this is hell, it's grinding me down, and it's making me stronger. So basically, they reframed it. They both had the same experience. It's a glass half full, half empty kind of moment, right? The glass is always 50%. But if you see it as half full, your brain changes. You feel less stressed. You feel better about it. And then you can better modulate your emotional response. But if you say, oh, it's half empty, you get stressed about it because it's half empty. You only have 50% left. Then you get stressed. Then you don't have recourse to analytical thinking in your brain because you start panicking. Your brain shuts down. You look at the situation in front of you and you can't really analyze it. So the person who feels negative about what they do can't manage it because their brain is resource poor. And the person who feels positive sees exactly the same thing, and they find avenues of action which are not available to the other person, even though on paper they may be identical in terms of physical capability and even brain power. It's amazing. You did that. It's brilliant.
Thank you. And thank you for explaining the mechanisms behind it so beautifully. And I sometimes try to get clients to do that when they're in a weight loss phase and hunger comes up. They're like complaining of hunger. I'm like, okay, I know your body's trying to send you the signal of you need to go and get food, but first of all, let's look at it logically. You want to lose 20 pounds of body fat. You have resources. You're not going to die in a second just because you're not listening to that hunger cue. Point number one. Point number two, let's reframe it as something positive, that what we're doing is actually working, that you're actually consuming less than what your body is burning. Therefore, you are gonna access those body fat stores that you want to get rid of. Oh, okay, sure. And number three, just think about, where your next meal is going to come from. It's not like you actually need to go and hunt for something, and there is a true for food shortage. But for sh shortage. But yes, to your point, like it is such a matter of point of view, of reframing things, of staying in control of our mind and not letting our mind run the show here and the physical cues take over. And this kind of leads me very nicely into another question I wanted to ask you. And part of your book also speaks about a fitness quote unquote recipe, which I absolutely loved, and especially that it was quite focused on reducing inflammation, because we all know that our environment and overload of stress and the foods that many people have access to or gravitate to, they're highly inflammatory. And if we're just in a chronic state of inflammation, we also know that leads to chronic diseases and so on, high risk of death. So please share a little bit of your fitness recipe with us and the components of that. I know it's very extensive, but maybe just a few pointers would be great.
Okay. I mean, basically, there's a thing to stress out, to sort of point out, which is that when it comes to fitness, the only true expert on us is us. You know, it's very difficult somebody to externally observe us and really know our true internal state. So we are the ones who have to take that responsibility. And, you know, sure, we all have access to experts like yourself, but we should be able to make use of that expertise properly in order to take responsibility instead of saying, oh, I'm in your hands now, which makes, you know, puts all the burden on you in order to manage another human being. And that's so difficult. It's just, you know, it's incredibly difficult sometimes. So if we are to take responsibility for ourselves, we need to understand what are the four components that we need in our life. And basically, we need to exercise, non-negotiable. We need to have good nutrition because that's a foundation of everything that we actually see physically as we observe our body. We need to have sufficient rest. So the quality of our sleep has to be there. And all these components, you know, they can be unfurled and sort of opened up into entire volumes of research and things we need to do. But these are the basics. And then there's the social element. And that is for our brain. Our brain is so complex. We can't possibly self-calibrate on our own. If I was to be locked up in a room for maybe a year without seeing anybody, by the time I'd come out, I'd probably be crazy. And that would happen to almost anybody. Why? Because the brain itself needs other people to calibrate its own reactions to an acceptable level and reach that homeostasis, which keeps it healthy. And when it hasn't got that, it's like a machine that can go wild, but there's nothing to actually help but self-diagnose. So we need other people to stay healthy mentally. If we have those four things, basically, in our life, and they're going to be different for us, and it's up to us to work out how we're going to do it. I mean, exercise can vary from people doing 16 hours a week of really intense exercise to people perhaps doing 5 hours a week, which is 1 hour a day of walking about. It's the nutrition itself can vary from the spectrum of vegans who eat only raw food to people who basically eat pretty much everything and try to, you know, control the quantities but limit themselves to nothing. Our physical makeup is also diverse in terms of its own responses to food and nutrition. So what works for one person doesn't necessarily work just as well for another person. And for somebody else, you know, they might have their own intolerances. So, you know, there's no prescription that will be suitable for everybody. So it's important to experiment. Excuse me. It's important to experiment. I choked. And through that experimentation, the one thing that will help us, and as we age ourselves, things will change. Our tolerance to some things will become better. Our tolerance to some other things will change. And that includes exercise. Our ability to stay up all night and then go to work the next morning kind of fades after we get past 20. So there you go, because the brain itself loses its tolerance to the toxicity that is created by losing a night's sleep. So knowing all these things, then we need to have the ability to evolve as we age, and also the ability to evolve in what we do as we change. And this is the ultimate fitness recipe, basically. It's do the things that are good for you and avoid the things that are bad for you. But know what those things are. Know how to put them together. Know how to seek the help that you need in order to fill the gaps in your knowledge. Understand that everything you do will have an impact, and then find ways to record what you're doing and measure that impact. I mean, there's zero possibility of changing something which we can't measure, because we have no idea how to change it and have no idea how to actually identify the impact it has on us. So In these days, everybody journals in some way. We all have phones, they all have apps. Keeping track of what we do has become really easy. And the only reason we don't is because we don't understand the true value of that. So once we understand that this is a very good way of seeing how our internal system works, it gives us a very granular picture of ourselves, what is good for us, what is bad for us, what can hurt us, what will help us. And then we become better managers of us. And that makes it sustainable in the long term in terms of how we feel, how fit we become, how well we feel inside our brain, how we operate when we're under stress. All these things are contingent on doing those actions.
Yeah, and you know what, David, and in regards to the awareness and the recording, I think it's so key because it really allows us to draw some correlations as well and to become kind of our own coach, because sometimes our feelings do blur or blunt the vision, and we're just like, oh, I feel horrible today. I'm going to punish myself with this extra long run or whatever, as opposed to just saying, hey, maybe you're just a bit more bloated because you ate out yesterday. Don't work out because you punish yourself. Work out because you want to feel better and because you know this is good for you. But having data is so valuable. I do really like that. But sometimes if we're too data focused, because I also have clients that are more like type A, and I'm kind of a recovering type A person as well, where you're so focused on the data that you are overriding or wanting to override your own intuition. And if I have learned one thing over the last few years, it's really our intuition is so powerful and can give us access to an even higher level of our physical and mental self. But with highly palatable foods these days, with highly stressed lives and so on, it's so hard to sometimes distinguish intuition or the right intuition from I haven't gotten enough sleep, I'm craving this and that food. Because if we give in to every single craving or whatever and call that intuition, that's not what intuition is. Like, if you think every time your body is telling you to eat chips, that's not your intuition, right? We need to distinguish between like what's actually going on there. And so sometimes the balance, I will say that I do find that quite difficult to teach, and also to learn for myself the right amount of, okay, where do we just follow the plan because it's the plan, and you don't listen to your intuition that wants to keep you in bed in the morning when you're supposed to work out, and we just ignore that and we go anyway, versus the day where you shouldn't work out super hard. You should listen to your body and just maybe do a yoga session instead and go for a walk or whatever because your body's calling for extra rest. I do think that it's hard. But over time, if you actually pause and listen and journal or meditate or even just sit there in stillness, your body, you will get better at listening to your body's cues. I truly believe that.
That's true. And I'm glad, again, I'm so glad you brought this up. There are two things you said that stand out, and they're incredibly valuable for your listeners to actually take on board. The first thing is that essentially, we can use exercise, all of us, as self-medication to make us feel better. And this is no different in terms of abuse than using alcohol, cigarettes, or any kind of other psychoactive substance. So we need to be aware of that. Sure, exercise will change us in the way we feel. It will decompress us, but at the same time, it's going to punish our body. And not everybody can take that kind of punishment. We will end up hurting ourselves. We'll end up changing our psychology a little bit about how we feel about exercise and how we relate to it, not for the better. So it's really important to take on board that. And the second thing he said is that over time we become experts in us, and we have to be able to distinguish the true signals of our intuition, which is essentially a mechanism that allows us to know things without really knowing them and kind of feeling them, as opposed to, have a craving for chips or have a craving for, Netflix tonight and not to exercise. Okay. And I think this is a skill set that actually built over time. That's why keeping a record and sort of examining it with kindness is important, as opposed to using it as a metric to beat ourselves up with. We're not measuring things so we can constantly go harder and better. This is not what we're doing. We're measuring things so we can see how our body can function optimally. And that needs kindness. We need to be able to say, okay, if I don't do this today because I really am tired. Will it actually impact me tomorrow? And let's see how it's going to change. And we should be able to experiment. It comes back to what I said earlier, that the only expert on us is us. But for us to become that expert, we really have to be accountable and we have to be responsible. So it's important to build this up.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I think this is a wonderful chapter. People should absolutely go into details on the fitness recipe and all the components of it. And one other chapter that really jumped out at me, and I could imagine actually at first, some people might brush over that because it's at first it might seem like an uncomfortable topic. And this is called the golden outcome, and in brackets you put death. And
Yes.
I mean, call me a little bit morbid, but I'm a little bit fascinated with death, and I'm a true believer. I love Stoic literature, and so I'm a true believer that sort of meditating on one's death or your loved one's death almost daily is actually very, very valuable in the sense of memento mori is kind of like a Stoic philosophy, because I think it just makes, first of all, it makes our problems seem a lot smaller. Second of all, it just makes it gives us more gets us more in touch with reality, and it's inevitable. We're all gonna die. Your loved ones are gonna die before or after you. And so the sooner we grasp that reality, the more we can actually live in the now and appreciate and value every single moment. But I was super fascinated that you put this chapter in there. I love this topic. And so I would just love for you to speak about why you wanted to include that and also just what it is about.
Yeah, certainly. And again, it's fascinating you actually have that kind of perspective in your life. I think it makes you able to function at a higher level. It allows you to create clarity out of the noise that's around us. And that's what it's all about, really. If we have an awareness of our own mortality, and logically we all do, right? You said we're all going to die. Nobody's going to argue about that. But we don't feel it. And we don't feel it for two reasons. One is that, again, we have this aversion to thinking about it because it makes us uncomfortable. And the second thing is that all of us fail to adequately project the future we're heading towards from the present that we experience. Our current experience, I feel great, I feel strong, I feel healthy, I'm happy. And really, I really don't want to consider my own death, even though I know it's a realistic thing. So we tend to block it off, right? But when we do that, this is what happens. We lose perspective of where we're going, and we also lose perspective of the actual cost benefit of the things which we do. And that leads us down many false paths. We can, again, if it comes to our own personal lifestyles, we can indulge, we cannot exercise because we still feel okay. We can, not have clarity in our thoughts, make mistakes in our life choices, when all these errors, and if we take this as a system, it becomes system errors and they accumulate. None of them are going to break us, but collectively they will. They will lead us down wrong paths. Our health will suffer. Our mental health will not be what it should be. Our life choices are going to be what it should be. Our decision making will actually become compromised. We'll become incapable of truly guiding our lives. And all because we started that from a wrong sort of point of view. We thought we are immortal, going to live forever. We're going to feel like the way we do now forever without any effort. And that's the change of perspective. The moment you realize that, it's not a given. If you want to be healthy 20 years from now, 30 years from now, if you want to be capable as you get older, which is inevitable, of moving your body the way you want to, of doing the things that you want to, of experiencing life as you want to, then you have to start building it now. And that awareness only comes from a true awareness of our mortality, of saying, okay, this is my time. I don't want to not experience it. I don't want to go through 10 years of pain or 10 or 15 years of life where it's no life at all because it's a waste of time. So I'm glad you said that. And that tends to make us a little bit more introspective. It enriches our internal world, our mental capabilities increase because of that, become a bit more analytical, a bit more careful in how we think about things. So these are all positives that come from that, which is why I included it.
As I said, it was one of my favorite aspects of the whole book, really, I will say, because I don't think it's mentioned enough, and I do think most of the time we think we have more time than we do in reality, or nowadays, actually, with our sort of sick care system, which is really good at treating immediate illness, as you mentioned, it's more likely that the last 20 whatever years of our life we just spend quite miserably, depending on care. We are not able to do the things that we want to do, and I'm sure many of the listeners, and perhaps you yourself as well, have experienced or have known people that passed away too soon, and they always thought they had more time, and it's heartbreaking when. It was an 18-year-old friend who passed away, or even, at any age, it really doesn't matter anyway. But people always think they have more time. I'll do that later. I'm going to use this decade now to just work and grind, even if it's horrible. No, I hate to break it to you. You might, at the end of this, you might die of a heart attack or whatever. Or I'm going to look for love later on. I'm going to care about my health, my health later on. Later is should be now. So truly, truly. Thank you from the bottom of my heart for including this chapter into your book. I will absolutely make sure that the listeners get the link to have access to your book. And just overall, David, I want to thank you for your time because I truly think it was a wonderful conversation, and I hope it inspired many people to go and read what you wrote and put together so beautifully there.
I sincerely hope so. Thank you so much for having me here.
My absolute pleasure. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with David. Thank you so much for tuning in. Go and give us both a follow on Instagram or YouTube. And remember, if you want personalized help with your nutrition and fitness goals, we'd love to guide you. One more thing before you go, if you're looking for premium supplements, our partner Fat Muscle Project has got you covered. Head to their website for the best protein powders, creatine, vitamin D, and more, and feel free to use our code NCL for your chance to win a $250 gift card. Thank you for listening.